Hartley here along with Romaine Patterson, Mr. Sam, our producer. And joining us now by phone, it's Dr. Christine McGinn. Christine is a plastic and reconstructive surgeon and the founder of the Papillon Gender Wellness Center, a comprehensive gender support center that includes a variety of professional services in addition to plastic surgery. And you can check her out on the web at drchristinemcginn.com. And her last name is spelled M-C-G-I-N-N. Christine, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys.
Hey, hello. Christine.
Hi, Romaine. Hi, Derek.
Hello.
First of all, before we get into talking to you about serious stuff, I just want to, because I haven't had a chance to talk to you, but I just want to extend a big congratulations to you and your partner, because I know you have some exciting stuff happening in your personal life, and I'm very excited for you guys.
So, well, thank you very much.
Just wanted to say that, just to get that out of the way. So welcome to the show. I've been looking forward to having you on the show since I met you. When the first time I met Christine was actually at my baby shower.
How ironic.
I know. Because Christine's partner, Lisa, is actually really good friends with my wife, Iris. So Dr. Christine, lots of stuff we want to talk about today. And one of the big things that I wanted to ask you about is a question that recently came in into the show, because you're not only a transgender lady, but you also help a lot of transgender folks out there with some of the stuff that they've got going on in their lives. And I recently had a question in my Dildo Whisperer segment of the show, where I dispense sex advice and sex toy advice about dilators. And this particular listener was looking for a good set of them, and I was completely at a loss. Completely and totally at a loss, which never happens to me during the Dildo Whisperer segment, but for the first time, I was completely at a loss. So I figure now that I have you here on the show, and this is something you might know something about, help.
Sure. Well, medical grade dilators are they are hard to come by, actually. Mm-hmm. And we actually use a brand called Soul Source, SOULSOURCE.
Okay.
And you can find them on the web.
Uh-huh.
But what's nice about them is they come in graduated sizes, so depending on how stretchy someone wants to be,
mm-hmm.
they can get different sizes.
Okay. All right. And for people who don't know what they are, do you mind explaining that, what they do?
Sure. Well, you know, to use your word dildo, I mean, it's not much different, except that it doesn't, it's pretty smooth, so it doesn't irritate the sides. But the reason we use them in our office is because after surgery, the inside of the vagina is made from skin that is relocated from another part of the body, scrotum and the penis. So we have to keep it dilated open, because scar tissue has a tendency to contract. So they have to use them for a period of time after surgery to keep everything open.
Okay. Now this leads me to the topic that I heard you wanted to discuss on the show, and I'm very excited. I've always been curious, what is the sex like when you have sex reassignment surgery? Because, you know, when you're fiddling with all of your sex parts, I would think, you know, there would be some changes that are happening there. So what is the sex like?
Well, it's a very complicated subject, but uh-huh. I'll try and keep it short, so to speak. The males and females come very, when they're in the womb, they're developing very similarly.
Right.
And so a lot of the organs are the same. So the clitoris and the glans penis are about the same, but the clitoris has about double the nerve endings as the glans penis. And then
right.
during the surgery, we trim down the glands to about, probably about one quarter of the size. So we go from, you know, 4,500 4,000 nerve endings to about a quarter of that.
Right.
But then in addition to that, though, we give patients greater access to the G-spot or the prostate, which are analogous organs. So,
okay.
So a lot of times the trans women that come through here really have never experienced a G-spot orgasm. So, you know, what they lose in nerve endings on the glans penis, they gain with the G-spot. So it does take a little bit of education and,
uh-huh.
so that they know what's where. And also hormones play a big factor in this, too.
Sure, I would assume so. Because, you know, when you're shifting all your hormones and you're changing all your hormones, I would assume that also messes with your sex drive and your libido and all that jazz.
Well, exactly. So sometimes after surgery, believe it or not, trans women actually have less testosterone in them than genetic women have, because genetic women have a small amount of testosterone in them. So oftentimes we'll give them a little bit of testosterone to boost their libido if they're complaining of that. Now for the guys, we don't want to leave the guys out.
Sure.
Going from female to male, that is never a problem because they got those 8,000 nerve endings.
Right.
And then they get the testosterone on top of that. So we never have complaints about the guys.
But, I mean, but there are major differences between the surgeries in terms of, like, the advances that are there. I mean, from what my understanding is that the surgery, if you are going from male to female, the surgeries are much more advanced and it's a little bit better transition, where a lot of trans men choose not to get bottom surgery because the technology is just not there to give them a real, true penis. And they feel like, you know what I get from the hormones is enough.
True. You know, it's easier to take something away than to build something in plastic surgery. But as far as, you know, it is very advanced, the surgeries that are available for the trans guys. However, it's also very expensive as well.
Sure.
There's, you know, we don't have enough time to talk about all the different surgeries that they can have. But the most advanced one is actually a free flap where they microsurgically attach tissue from other parts of the body. And in this country, given the state of health insurance not covering most of this, it's really cost prohibitive. It's upwards of $60,000 to $100,000 for that surgery. Yeah.
Wow. Well, actually, on that topic, let's go to Breanne in Salt Lake. Breanne, you're on Derek and Romaine with Dr. Christine McGinn, a plastic and reconstructive surgeon who works in a gender support center.
Yeah. Hi, doctor. I'm aware that you are doing a lot of work for, like, insurance, just trying to further insurance, you know, get coverage and stuff. And I was wondering if there's any headway being made there, because it's like, I mean, you know, like you were just saying, it's impossible to save up for some of these surgeries. And is there any way to get, you know, a lot of some of the procedures done, like backdoor, like sometimes they will get a nose job or something covered, you know, say it was a deviated septum. Is there other procedures like that can be covered?
Well, we have to be careful. Yeah. Well, it's difficult in this insurance environment, and that's why it's very important that we, you know, try and get in with the insurance reform to include this as a necessary, you know, treatment for this, because really we know that it's a serious condition, because untreated, you know, up to 25% of transgender people can attempt suicide.
Right.
And the incidence has been described, you know, as low as 1 in 2,500, but, you know, to be safe, 1 in 4,500. So we have a lot of people who have this. It's had serious consequences, and we have, you know, a treatment which involves therapy, hormones, and surgery that is 99% effective, and we don't see that often in the medical field. So less than 1% of people regret this, and here we have it all in place and ready to go, but insurance doesn't cover it. But to answer your question, it's really we're not seeing a lot of advances with the insurance. And unless you have any, you know, for example, with the nose you talked about, you would have to have a problem like a septal deviation for that to be covered.
Right.
All right. And I'm sure this is something that, you know, may or may not be resolved with the healthcare debate that's going on in D.C. I assume that it probably won't make it into this bill with all the things that are going on there. There has been on the more, you know, sort of futuristic side, there has been some success in the lab with growing penile tissue, although not like an actual penis, but they have grown other parts in a lab, like ears and that kind of things that they've attached to people. So, Christine, what kind of how close do you think we are to this kind of science actually being made real and practical?
Well, to actually grow all the components of the penis would be very difficult. It's a very complicated structure.
Sure.
Mostly because of the erectile tissue. It has so many different types of tissue within one structure. I see that as being a good way off. I think if you were to guess as to the next surgery available, you know, transplant would probably be easier to do than growing it. Although, you know, we're making advances so quickly that, you know, it's difficult for me to estimate. It's more of an, you know, the problem is more of an ethics question. You know, we're so far behind on the laws and the ethics of all of this.
Right.
You know, can you imagine what would happen to the organ donor program if people, you know, thought that their penis might go for a transplant to somebody else? So these all, you know, these questions are mainly, you know, people who just are ignorant to the real facts. And so I think that's the biggest hurdle right now.
So let's step back for a second and talk about, because we have a lot of transgender listeners who listen to the show, and a lot of them are over the road truckers, and you know, some of them are in very early stages of their transition. So let me ask you this, Dr. Christine, what are the first steps that someone should consider taking if they are looking at the surgery option?
Well, I think that the way it should start is I'm a proponent of the what's called the standards of care. And initially, those were created by the Harry Benjamin Association.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a long history to that. If you want to hear more about the history of the Harry Benjamin Association, you could check out sexsmartfilms.com.
Okay.
For free, you can check it out. However, now that organization is now called WPATH, and they describe, you know, a standard for people to go through in order to have a safe transition, and I do agree with all of that. But the first step would be to find a good therapist who has experience with transgender care. And the reason is because, you know, it's very difficult to do this because society oftentimes pushes the other way. So it's good, mm-hmm. you know, even if you don't have any mental health issues, you know, you need somebody on your side. Because oftentimes these folks will lose their family and their friends. Not
right.
always,
right.
but, you know, it's good to have a good support system.
Absolutely. We're actually going to be talking to a therapist after we get done talking with you.
Oh, great.
So
yes. So we'll be going a little backwards, the way people normally do it. But in this case, it's radio. It's not exactly the same thing.
True.
But I assume that once somebody has worked with a therapist and are ready to move forward with surgery, now, do you sit down with them and talk over the range of options that are available to them?
Yes. Yeah. By the time they get to my office and we start talking about surgery, because we also do hormones here too.
Right.
So normally they'll see a therapist for a few months, and as soon as the therapist feels and the client feels they're ready, sometimes they'll come to me for the hormones, and we'll sit down and we'll talk about the hormones, which I like very much because, like I said, you know, I'm in the business of making penises and vaginas, and when we're talking about the sexual function of those, I mentioned that the hormones have a huge impact
sure.
on everything. So I like to get them at the beginning stages of everything so we can sit down and talk about the effects, because a lot of times they're left going from one clinic here that does therapy, one here that does hormones, and they miss a lot of information to pull it all together for them. So mm-hmm. once they have the hormones and then they've been the standard of care recommends that they live as that gender for a period of time, usually 1 year,
mm-hmm.
to make sure that everything's going to fall into place for them. You know,
right.
what we would hate to see is someone go through the surgery and have everything in place and then not be able to, you know, emotionally fall apart because they lose their job or their relationship.
Right.
So we like to make sure we put their training wheels on first for a little while.
Well, it's interesting because and usually I can't stand this show for some of its sensitivities, but Nip Tuck actually just had an episode this week with Candace Kane, the actress, and she went in as, you know, a transgender lady who had already had her surgery and now wanted to reverse it. So does that actually happen? Are there people out there who transition and then do have that regret? And what do you do in a situation like that?
You know, a lot of people talk about that, but we don't really see it. Like I said, the process is so, you know, rigorous ahead of time. It's been well documented that less than 1% have any regrets.
Right.
And usually those are more associated with some sort of surgical complication or a problem in their life afterwards.
Uh-huh.
You know, losing a spouse, losing their family, especially losing their kids. And I think the answer is more to educate people as to, you know, the facts about, you know, this condition, and so that there's not so much discrimination and hatred.
Yeah, because certainly there is a and there has been in place for quite some time a fairly rigorous psychological process that people would go through before they got to the surgery stage, which would help them both resolve a lot of the issues that would come up post-surgery, but also to make sure that they were, you know, that this was definitively the step they wanted to take.
Right. And in the past, those standards of care were much different. Initially, they wanted to make sure that you were actually going to be heterosexual in your new gender and that, you know, you were divorced. And so those types of older standards have gone by the wayside.
Thank
as
goodness.
We progress. Yeah, really.
That's just kind of crazy. Because, you know, I mean, gender identity and sexual orientation really don't have anything. They're completely different things.
They really are. However, you know, some of these rules and laws have overlapped to them.
Right.
You know, I just had a patient 2 weeks ago who it was a trans man, and he had been with his partner for some years, and they have 3 kids together. And he legally was still female in the state that he was in.
Uh-huh.
And he had been at his job for 25 years and was ready for this, you know, all the retirement benefits. But his family wasn't eligible. And so he was calling, and he wanted surgery just so that legally he could have the benefits for his family. And I thought that that was so sad. And I said to him, well, why don't you take the money for surgery and get yourself a good lawyer? And he said, well, you know, that process would take so long that I would lose the benefits for them.
Wow.
You know, this is someone who's transgender, been living as a man for decades, really.
Right.
And everything in his life was going great. But he just wants to provide for his family like any other man. So, you know, 2 things could happen to help this out. Either, you know, if he could get married legally as, you know, a woman and a woman,
mm-hmm.
that probably wouldn't be his first choice. But I mean, there's where the gay, you know, marriage comes into
sure.
place and the benefits of that. Or, you know, relax these laws about, you know, what it means to be a male or female, you know, legally. This guy had already undergone top surgery, and it wasn't enough for that state.
Yeah, it's very.
That is so sad.
Yeah, it is very difficult to imagine.
Oh, it sucks.
I hear these stories just about every week in my
office.
I'm sure
you do. And now you obviously have this really amazing office. How many? I mean, are you the only one doing this? Are there other offices like yours throughout the country? I mean, how prevalent are these resources for the trans folks out there?
Well, there's some really great surgeons in North America that perform the surgery and have a lot of experience doing
uh-huh.
it. But, you know, it's not like, you know, going downtown and, you know, having your appendix out, that's for sure.
Yeah.
There's probably about 4 or 5 places in the country that do a lot of volume, more than 100 a year.
Okay.
Wow.
Wow. And then you had also mentioned what a vital role hormones take in all of this. In your own practice, have you seen that what percentage of the transition do you feel for your patients happens just on a hormonal level as opposed to a surgical level?
Ooh, that's a good question. And I think that, you know, when people ask me, you know, I'll have patients come to me because they know that I'm really interested in post-operative orgasm and to make sure that we talk about these things. And I'll have patients come to me who had surgery, you know, 10, 20 years ago. And, you know, the answer is it's the hormones, stupid, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't talk to my patients like that. But, I mean, it's just like as a general rule, you know, hormones are very powerful. And
sure.
having the opportunity to both administer hormones and in surgery, I really see, you know, I'm very humbled, you know, when I have a trans man come into the office and we sit down and we talk about what's going to happen, you know, when we start the testosterone, and then I'll call them a month later and not even recognize them on the phone because their voice changed so much. So this is why, you know, it's important, and I'm a big believer in the standards of care to make sure that people are really ready for this
mm-hmm.
and that they don't treat it lightly, because hormones and surgery have, you know, permanent, you know, implications for people.
Absolutely.
And I
actually
think the system works, you know. I think that that's the reason why we have such a low, you know, incidence of people that have any sort of regret at all about it.
Yeah. And I mean, just today I was watching Chaz Bono on Good Morning America, and they addressed the fact that Chaz started hormones already. And you could tell in the voice already had changed.
Right. And with those changes come small differences in how you do like standard preventative medicine. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the person who is on estrogen and has a vagina, you know, needs and is it was older when they transitioned, you know, they're still at risk for prostate cancer. It may have right. had started before they started their transition, and they still need to have the prostate check. But, you know, the family doctor might not know that if the person passes very well.
Right.
So these are things, you know, I try and make my patients advocates for themselves so that they know all these important preventive medicine things to do.
I wouldn't even have thought about something as simple as that.
Yeah, there's a lot of them, you know, a lot of little things. And the problem is like when I talk to my patients, you know, there's not a lot of money for research to actually, right. you know, we can't even get, you know, who should get a mammogram or a pap smear down if you've watched the news
oh,
lately.
Yeah.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so when my trans women come to me and say, well, do I need a mammogram? You know, it's, you know, as much research has been done on genetic females, there's really barely anything done right. on trans people. And so that's what I would like to see, too. And hopefully maybe at my clinic here, we can start, you know, getting some grants and doing some research.
Well, I have actually personally met a couple ladies who were coming to see you, Dr. Christine, and they said, she's beautiful. I cannot wait to have this surgery done. And so I just have to say, I'm so glad that you are out there and that you are helping to educate people and doing the important work you do, because, you know, I feel like the trans community just doesn't get the resources that they need. And I'm glad to see that you're out there doing that work.
Well, thank you very much.
You bet. And thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Derek.
Absolutely. Our thanks to Dr. Christine McGinn for joining us. And you can check out the Papillon Gender Wellness Center, which she's the founder of, by going online to drchristinemcginn.com. And her last name is spelled M-C-G-I-N-N. That's Christine with a C.
Yep.
Okay, coming up next, we are going to be joined by therapist Robin Sexton, who's going to talk about the mental health aspects of transitioning, the other side of this coin, as our coverage of the National Day of Remembrance continues here on Derek and Romaine.
Derek and Romaine on OutQ, Sirius 109, XM 98.
This holiday season just got more fun.
Oh, yes, it did, Derek. Oh, yes, it did.
With the Xbox 360.
Yeah, I love my Xbox 360. I've had one for years now. And part of the reason why I love it is because when I've had a bad day, there's nothing better than putting my Xbox.